This is Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Lana, not Lena or Lana, but Lana. It's a common name in Russia. My guest today, Greg Johnson, is the editor-in-chief of Countercurrents Publishing and its journal and webzine, North American New Right. He is the author of Confessions of a Reluctant Hater and also New Right versus Old Right, which we'll spend the hour focusing on. We'll cover a lot of ground and discuss the message of the new North American right. And of course, if there is a new right, there must be a new left. He'll distinguish how the two differ today. Greg shares his vision of European ethno-metapolitics and distinguishes it from fascism and national socialism. What is ethno-nationalism and how can it enable peace for everyone? We'll also ask the question that people avoid, is human inequality such a bad thing? Later, Greg sets out some basic principles for creating a growing, resilient, networked movement of fellow Europeans who share the drive to break off from our current decaying society to construct a new republic with a healthy consciousness to uphold our folk. At the end, we'll discuss a chapter from Greg's book called The Perils of Positive Thinking. He explains why positive thinking ultimately cannot save us from the state we're in, both metaphorical and literal. Greg, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, I regularly check in on and greatly enjoy your website, Countercurrents, and I am curious about your conversion into nationalism. So tell us how it happened for you.
Well, I went through a process, a long process, mostly based upon reading and observing things around me. From being a libertarian when I was an undergraduate student to becoming more conservative by the end of my undergraduate years. And then when I went into graduate school, I was a conservative. I read a lot of neoconservative stuff. The New Criterion was one publication that I subscribed to. I subscribed to Commentary, primarily because I like the higher intellectual quality of the neocon writing. In terms of policies, I was more a paleocon, I guess, but I like the neocon writing. Never could stand National Review. Couldn't even look at it. It was such an ugly magazine. Stupid, too. When I was in graduate school, basically, I started realizing that, first of all, we're not just universal human beings, right? That we have specific identities. And of course, the liberal project is sort of premised, and the libertarian project is premised on the idea that there's just this universal humanity where these universal bearers of rights, we're basically fungible and interchangeable. Wherever we go, we're the same. And that idea, I think, is fundamentally false. It goes along with this idea from the Enlightenment that ultimately we can settle everything by appeals to reason, by appeals to nature. Whereas I think really in the area of politics, ultimately what happens is you end up making an argument from identity. In political debates, you come back to a principle like this. Well, this is just who I am. This is just what I'm comfortable with, and I can't budge. And in other words, politics ultimately boils down to appeals to identity and being true to yourself. And since there are many different identities, many different groups, if you have those non-negotiable appeals to identity, you're going to have conflict, right? The idea of the Enlightenment is that we can resolve all conflicts because reason is one and truth is one and reality is one, and we can talk it all out and we can come to a consensus. But if in the realm of practical affairs, you ultimately come back to appeals to identity and identity is plural, that whole conflict resolution model is out the window. And therefore, we're never going to live in a world where there's peace and there's no enmity. And really, the only way that we're going to live in a peaceful world or maximize the amount of peace in the world is we have to allow different peoples with different identities to have their own spaces where they don't have to argue with others, where they don't have to convince others, where they can just live according to their identities, according to the way of life that feels natural to them. And this is true of individuals too. Just have to share a bathroom with somebody, right? Or have to share a room, a bedroom with somebody. And you find that there's conflict. And that conflict can be easily removed if you just don't have to share certain spaces.
Right.
I think it was Virginia Woolf who talked about how there would be just as many great women writers as men writers if they only had a room of their own to go to. My feeling is that nationalism is basically the idea that we all have a country of our own to go to, a place where we can retreat and be ourselves and not be on trial by the standards of universal reason or by the different standards of our neighbors, but where we can simply relax and be at home and be ourselves. And so I became a nationalist really when I realized that there are certain irreducible differences between people and that those have to be respected and honored. And that's the only route to a world that's going to be as close to utopia as possible, where everybody has a country of their own.
Well said. And I read your book, New Right versus Old Right, which for me was a lot of fun. But for those just hearing about the New Right, what is new about the North American New Right? And how does it differ from the Old Right and the European New Right?
Well, these are good questions. First of all, I need to say that it was in the 70s that some French journalists basically labeled Alain de Benoist as an exponent of something called the New Right. He's never been comfortable with that term. His followers have never been comfortable with that term. They always sort of clear their throats and announce that they're not comfortable with that and that this is a term that other people have placed upon them. Personally, I'm just going to claim that term. I'm sort of following Jonathan Bowden in this. He sort of claimed the term New Right. I think it's an okay term because I think that, first of all, it's meaningful to talk about being right wing. I think what's essential about the right is that we believe that human inequality is not always a bad thing. The left is elitist in practice, but in terms of their principles, in terms of their values, they're anti-elitist, they're egalitarian. And I think that that is an essential difference between left and right. In many of my policy views, in many of my sort of lifestyle choices, you know, and the kinds of people I hang out with and the kinds of coffee bars and neighborhoods I go to, I'm pretty liberal. However, in terms of my basic value orientation, I'm a rightist because I believe that inequality is natural, it's normal, and it's good. Now, what's the difference between the new right and the old right? I think that really you have to talk about the difference between the new left and the old left in order to understand that. The old left was totalitarian. It was militant. It was basically imperialistic, and it was certainly genocidal. We're talking about classical communism. And after the Second World War, basically something called the New Left, first it was called Western Marxism, but then the New Left was a term that was used in the 1960s primarily, that emerged. And it was an alternative to the totalitarian political model. And basically what it aimed to do was advance the values of the left through different means. Instead of battles in the streets or on battlefields in the old left style, basically what they did is they took a page from Antonio Gramsci, the Italian Marxist, and talked about attaining hegemony in culture. Classical Marxism basically claims that culture is an epiphenomenon of economics and politics. Therefore, to change the culture, you change the political and economic sublevel of society. Whereas Gramsci said, no, we can actually change politics by changing the culture, by changing the way people think and perceive the world. The new left basically has created the strange phenomenon that we have today of a left-wing capitalist oligarchical society. We have a hyper-oligarchical capitalist society, and yet all of its reigning values are basically leftist. And the reason why that's the case is that the left, particularly after the Second World War, put a huge amount of its emphasis on changing culture, changing ideas, and they have achieved a kind of cultural hegemony. And I think that the new right needs to take a page from the new left. We need to reconfigure our project so that we're not imitating old right models anymore. And a lot of people on the right today really do have old right models. You know, they want to have a uniformed militant political party, right, that's centralized and has a leadership principle and aims to create some kind of totalitarian society. What we need to do is we need to deconstruct the existing intellectual and cultural hegemony of the left. And we do that through intellectual and cultural means. And we need to construct a new hegemony, a rightist hegemony, that basically makes the preservation of our race a non-negotiable political principle across the whole political spectrum. That's the aim, as I conceive of it, as the new right. Now, I have to say something, and that is that the old right was totally legitimate in the tactics that they chose. It was totally legitimate for Hitler and Mussolini to choose paramilitary organizations, centralization, and a militant kind of totalitarian one-party politics. Why? Because that's what they were fighting against, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. They were fighting against communism, and communism was one of the great dangers that our civilization has faced, the greatest danger since the Muslim invasions, and before that, you know, the Mongols and the Huns. Communism is one of the worst things that ever happened in human history, and they had to fight it, and they had to fight it using its own means because liberal democracy was not up to the task. So that said, I think it was totally legitimate for them to adopt the strategies and tactics of their enemies in order to defeat them. However, the enemy has adopted new strategies and tactics, and we need to be just as supple and flexible. We need to keep our aims the same. And I do think the aims of the new right are basically the same as the old right. We want some kind of organic society that's ethnically defined. But at the same time, we need to change our means of getting there in order to effectively combat the way that we're actually being ruled, which is not through totalitarian, sort of a hard totalitarianism, but through a kind of soft intellectual totalitarian hegemony that the left has created in our culture today.
Now, if you boiled down the message of the new North American right, what would it be?
Basically, that's a good question. And basically, what I say is that what we stand for is truth, justice, and a nice white country. That's what we want. The enemy stands for lies and injustice and multiculturalism. They stand for mixing it all up and making a pigsty of every white country that exists. Political correctness, which is sort of the face of the left today, what does that basically boil down to? It boils down to a kind of moralistic drama of lying, right? Political correctness basically has two aspects. One, it's false excuses for privileged groups. And two, it's false accusations of blame directed at us, at white people. That is injustice. It's lying and it's injustice. What we stand for is truth. We're going to tell the truth about race. We're going to tell the truth about identity. We're going to tell the truth about what makes a society work. Justice for us means treating people appropriately given their nature. It's just to treat equal people equally. It's unjust to treat unequal people equally. And since people are all different, our view of justice basically boils down to treating people appropriately. And that is going to create a hierarchical sort of society. Some people are going to have more. They're going to have more stuff. They're going to have more responsibility. They're going to have more fame and acclaim. Others are going to have less. But we're going to make sure that that is appropriate to real differences in their nature. It's not just based on birth or wealth and things like that. And the third principle, the nice white country, well, that's the aim. We want to create an ethnostate. We want to create a lot of ethnostates. And by ethnostates, I mean basically sovereign entities where distinct ethnic groups have their own country. And that means the Swedes, but it also means the Piedmontese, right? It means the Sicilians. There are lots of different ethnic groups that don't have their own countries today. I was a big supporter of Scottish independence, and I'd love to see Wales become independent too. I really do think that the best solution again, for ethnic conflict. And the best way to create conditions of peace and progress is to create separate homelands for all the different distinct white ethnic groups. In the United States, we have more of a generic white humanity. I think that maybe what will happen in the United States is, what I hope will happen in the United States, is the United States will break up into regions, probably along existing jurisdictions, along state boundaries, things like that, or sub-boundaries within states. And so there might be many different white areas in North America. I think that would be a good thing. So anyway, again, we stand for truth, justice, and a nice white country, lots of nice white countries. And to gain that, we believe that we're going to have to redraw borders, and we're going to have to move populations around. I think that one of the worst betrayals of Nick Griffin in the British National Party is to give up the idea of repatriating non-whites from England.
Mm-hmm.
These people have no business being there, absolutely no business whatsoever. And if it was feasible for these people to be brought there in the millions, it's feasible for them to leave in the millions. There's nothing that stands in the way of doing that except the political will and courage to do it. And it can be done in a completely humane fashion. Doesn't even have to be a giant government program. Most of these people came under their own volition. They can leave under their own volition once we make clear that this is what we want and once we create incentives for that to happen. So I again, a nice white country is going to require changing boundaries and it's going to require moving populations. But we think it's worth it because ultimately, if we don't have white nationalism, our race is going to become extinct. The white race is on the path to extinction right now. If current trends continue, there will be no white people in the world. And the only way to really prevent white extinction is for us to have our own sovereign homelands.
Now, some people will say, isn't this fascism or national socialism? So how would you distinguish the difference here?
First of all, I'm not going to just say, oh, no, we're not like those horrible people. We are like those people, and I don't think they're horrible, okay? I think fascism and national socialism were totally legitimate responses to their time, and that they also contain within them things of permanent value. And at the core of them is the idea of restoring a kind of organic, hierarchical society in the context of modernity. And I think that is a reasonable goal. There's a critique of capitalism. There's a critique of liberalism. There's a critique of internationalism and globalization. All of those things are completely valid, and I want to maintain those. I want to maintain their concern with race, specifically the German National Socialists were very concerned with that. The Italians sort of lagged behind. I want to preserve their concern, their absolutely important concern, with identifying the Jewish question, the Jewish problem. That has to be kept fully in mind. So there's a lot about these people that I agree with and I want to preserve. What's the difference? Well, like I said, I think at the time when they were fighting against totalitarian, imperialist, and genocidal communism, they adopted appropriate countermeasures. They took a gun to a gunfight. Today, we're ruled not by hard totalitarian leftism. We're ruled by a kind of soft totalitarian cultural and intellectual hegemony. And instead of taking a gun to a battle of ideas, we need to take ideas to a battle of ideas. So that's really the difference. And what is the outcome as I view it? Well, my view is this. We live in a society where we have tremendous choices and people feel quite free. The average person feels free. We don't feel free because we see the strings, right? The average person feels quite free. They have all kinds of trivial options to choose from in toothpaste, in politics, and so forth. And it just so happens that the left, and at the core of the left, really, is the organized Jewish community. When I talk about left-wing domination, I really am talking about Jewish domination, Jewish hegemony. They're the key, the core to the left, and they always have been. What we have in America today is we have a range of political options, but every one of those political options is carefully vetted so that it's safe for Jews and it's conducive to Jewish interests. Now, I don't see any reason to change that system, the basic system of having lots of choices. I just want to make sure that once the new right attains power, that all the political choices that people have available to them are safe for whites, right? White genocide, white extinction, white degradation is going to be off the table and no longer an option for anybody up and down the political spectrum. You simply can't choose that, just like you simply can't choose anything that endangers Jewish interests today. I think that whites in white countries should be as sacrosanct as Jews are today.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically the end point. So what would it look like? Well, it would look a lot like today if I had my druthers. There'd be lots of choices. There'd be pluralism in politics. But behind the scenes, basically, there would be a consensus that would vet every political candidate, that would be working to create a culture that would be conducive to white interests. There would be lots of differences. Whites would still be arguing about abortion and taxes and feminism and so forth, but it would just be an argument within the family, basically, right? We would have family differences, and there would be no option of bringing in outsiders as allies to try to gain advantages over members of one's own extended family. So that's the end game as I conceive of it. Not such a scary prospect because liberals today live under that system. It's just that it's a system that is rigged to destroy them and their values and all the rest of us. I just want to get rid of that rigging, so to speak. I want to get rid of the anti-white bias and the pro-Jewish bias and switch the system around so it preserves and enhances our interests.
Yeah, you talk about why you think it's important for white nationalists to adopt an elitist strategy, and you also talk about directing the message to the educated, the professional classes and above to mold the masses. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. First of all, I don't want to carry around the banner of elitism primarily. I think that that's something of a mistake. It's necessary. You have to say it in some context. But we're never going to have a political movement that is potent if we go around saying, you know, we're elitists. You know,
sure.
Vote for us. Vote for the few. It's never going to happen because most people are going to look at that and they're going to say, well, what's in your elitism for me? And my attitude about elitism is that it is an inevitable consequence of justice. And there's something in justice for everybody. And so this is why I say, you know, truth, justice in a nice white country. Justice is something that everybody wants, unless you're bad and then you don't want to get what you deserve, right? But most people want to be treated justly. And one law for the ox and the lion, as William Blake says, is injustice. So what you have to do is you have to have laws that treat equal people equally and unequal people unequally. Aristotle called this proportional equality. The idea is that people should be unequal, proportionate to their real worth. That's the model that we want. And what that means is that there will be people who have more responsibility, more fame, etc., based on their worth. Now, I think that's important to bear in mind. What we stand for is justice, but justice will lead to a hierarchy in society. And what we want is we want to make sure that that is a just hierarchy rather than the unjust kind of hierarchies that exist today. Even though we have a society that's constantly paying lip service to equality, it's a very stratified and very unjust society. So where does elitism come in terms of our strategy? Well, we have to recognize that for the most part, history is made by minorities. Most people don't have the time or the understanding or the education to have an impact on society. Most people are just dragged along by the few, by the elites. That's always been the case. The best sort of situation for a people is to have an elite that is organically connected to them and that looks out for their interests. I wrote a piece for Countercurrents called Notes on Populism, Elitism, and Democracy. It's actually in the New Right versus Old Right book. And what I make clear in there is that I'm a populist in the sense that I believe that the only legitimate political system looks out for the interests of all the people. Okay. However, I also argue that the political system that best looks out for the interests of all people is going to be one where the leadership is, on average, better than the masses. And most people understand that instinctively. We want our leaders to be better than us on average, just as we want our doctors to know more about medicine than we do, and our dentists to know more about teeth than we do, and the guy who sets up our new TV to know more about TVs than we do, right?
Mm-hmm.
We recognize that expertise gives authority, and we want that in politics as in every other area of life. Yet at the same time, we want these experts to be responsive to the interests of the whole. So that's my idea. I think we have to be populist in the sense that we look out for the interests of everybody, elitist in the sense that we recognize that the best way to do that is to have people who are on average smarter and more public-spirited in positions of authority. Now, to get that, what we need to do in the present day is we need to create that elite. Our race is leaderless. There's nobody looking out for the interests of white people. The people who run our societies are looking out for the interests of Jews. They're looking out for the interests of themselves. They're looking out for the interests of the rich, basically. Nobody's looking out for the interests of whites. If we're going to have a society where white interests are sacrosanct, we're going to have a leadership caste that looks out for white interests. And the only way to get that is to start appealing to people today who are better than average in terms of intelligence, morality, public-spiritedness, taste, and so forth, and try to create that leadership caste that we're going to need down the road. So my approach is basically to search all existing social classes, all existing white constituencies. I'm spreading a very broad net. I want to find the best white people for the cause. And I want to persuade the best white people of my vision of things and to get them writing, thinking, organizing, and becoming that organically connected elite that will provide the leadership caste for our race. Because eventually we're going to have to take control politically of our own destiny again. And to do that, we have to have the leadership to do that. So that's my goal. And that's why I have an elitist focus. And by an elitist focus, I do not mean that I'm just appealing to the educated. I'm trying to appeal to the best people in all political classes, in all social classes, in all levels of education. There are lots of really bright people who've never been to college. And some, in fact, some of the brightest people I know are largely self-educated. So I'm not a snob in the social class sense of the term, although I do recognize that people with better educations and more money do have more power in society. But I am a snob in the sense that I want to find the best people, no matter where they are in the current social system, and I want to bring them into my vision of things because I do think we need a leadership caste that will actually take the interests of our race into account.
Now, you also write about the need to focus on metapolitics, and you compare it to occult warfare, and the points you talk about is one, propaganda, two, community organizing. Can you talk about this?
Yeah, metapolitics is just a term that refers to the things that have to be established for there to be political change. And basically what I do is I break metapolitics down into two categories. One is the battle of ideas, propaganda, basically. And two, community organizing. There are certain ideas that need to be established in people's minds if we're going to live in a white nationalist society. We have to get people concerned with the danger to our race. We have to awaken people to the fact that there are bigger problems than abortion and school prayer and what's going on in the Middle East. Namely, our race is becoming extinct. It's that dire. And we need to be as worried about white extinction as some people are worried about Bengal tigers and snail darters and rare frogs that are going extinct as well. We're going to be extinct. And when the white race goes extinct, all those other species are going to go extinct too, because we're the only ones who really care about preserving them. So we need to awaken people to the danger. We need to awaken people to their identity. We need to get white people to think of themselves as white people and to think of themselves as white people unapologetically. So there's a moral element to this too. We have to teach people that it's not only normal to belong to a group, but it's also right to take your group's side in conflicts. White people have had that notion bred out of them, and we need to start taking our own side because we do live in a world of ethnic conflicts. And we also need to have ideas about what's feasible. Nobody is going to accept the idea of the white ethno-state if they think that it's simply impossible to create. And so we have to convince people that it is possible. So these are metapolitical ideas that need to be argued out and established, and they need to be propagated to all white groups. And we need to have ways of propagating these things and making them appealing to every white constituency, every white age group, every white ethnic group, every white nation, and so forth. So that's important. That's the intellectual aspect of metapolitics.
And that's why political diversity among pro-whites can also be a good thing, right?
Whites are a diverse group, and pro-whites are going to need to be able to speak to all different groups. And so the more diversity among pro-whites, the more ways that we have of matching up with the existing diversity of white groups. And so it helps us, right? We should embrace that. That's a strength. It really is a strength. Now, the community organizing aspect of metapolitics is basically the idea that, well, it's got to be more than just ideas. We have to have existing communities among white people. I'm not talking about political parties. That's politics proper. I'm talking about metapolitics. I'm just talking about real-world networks, families, extended families, tribes, mutual aid networks, existing businesses and things like that where we have our people. We have to think in terms of taking it off the internet and geographically localizing things and building real communities. So that's the second part of metapolitics. My focus is on those two things, mostly on the battle of ideas, because I'm just one guy out here on the internet, right? So that's primarily what I can do. However, one of the things that I do try and do in the community organizing field is to bring together people that I know of who are in the same area, but who might not know one another, and get them to meet one another and try and foster face-to-face interactions amongst our readers. Countercurrents is a node. You know, I have all this information going out and I have all these people checking in. When people check in, they say, hey, I like your work. Here's a donation. Here's a book order. I look at the address and I say, wait a second here. I know another guy in the same little town in Florida that you're in right now. Do you want to meet? And they say, yeah, sure. And so I put these people in touch, and suddenly two very lonely dissidents have somebody that they can meet for coffee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's great.
It's a small beginning, but you know, the longest journey begins with a single step, right? So another thing that I do to this end is I go around and make occasional talks and meet people in the real world. I used to have these dinners and things like that. And at these dinners, I discovered that there were a couple of people in the same town who came to my dinner, but they didn't know each other in the real world. So I made sure that, you know, everybody in the room raised their hands and said what town they're from. And I said, hey, you two are from Petaluma. You better get together, you know, after the talk and exchange cards. So I've done that kind of stuff. I'd like to do more of it. But, you know, there's only so many hours in the day.
Sure.
But so those are two areas that I'm focused on. And I'm hoping that if the metapolitical foundations are strong, right, then somebody's going to come along with the right combination of political skills and charisma at the right time politically, and suddenly it's going to be possible for there to be a really effective political movement that will just gel. But until those metapolitical foundations are in place, there's going to be a lot of headwind against it. It's going to be very thin and astroturfy. There's going to be no grassroots basis for it because there's no real grassroots white community, a conscious white community, right? Most of our people are unconscious, and we have to change that.
Well, some people claim that the genocide of Europeans is something we did to ourselves, and I know you strongly oppose this. So to what extent is white dispossession our fault?
Well, once we are fully aware of the problem and we choose to do nothing, I think then we become part of the problem, right? However, most people are not responsible for what's happening to them. Again, politics is something that is created by elites, and it's done to most people. White dispossession is being done to white people. And I really strongly oppose this sort of grandiose idea that people say, oh, we're doing it to ourselves. Our race is committing suicide. It's not true. Our race is not committing suicide. Some people are doing this to the rest of us. And who are those people? Well, they're disproportionately Jews. They're not even whites. And so my view is that it's closer to the truth to say that whites are being murdered and that the people who are putting in place the trends that are leading to white dispossession and white extinction are disproportionately Jewish, and that Jews are not only disproportionately responsible for setting up this system, they are the main impediment to changing it. And I think that's an important distinction. A lot of whites will get sidetracked, basically, arguing about what percentage of our problems are caused by Jews as opposed to Christianity or capitalism or whatever. And it's an argument about whether we're doing it to ourselves or whether it's being done to us. That can be sterile, arguing that point. We can do that forever. Ultimately, though, we're not a debating society, and we're not here to establish merely historical points. We're here to change the future. And when you talk about changing the future, when you talk about changing the existing trends that are destroying our race, ask yourself, who's standing in the way? It's the organized Jewish community. They are the linchpin of resistance to every sensible policy to limit white extinction, basically, white dispossession. And so when you start thinking politically and you start looking at who lines up against us, it's the Jews. The Jews are the linchpin of it. They're not the sole group. They're very small in number. They're very powerful, and they have power because they're good at making coalitions, right? So the Jews are the core of this minority, disgruntled coalition, of course, which basically, you know, it's the majority of humanity when you start incorporating all non-whites into it. But within white societies, they organize non-white minorities, they organize gays and lesbians, they organize environmentalists, anybody on the left. They try and organize and make part of their coalition in order to project power. Yet at the same time, when you look at which policies dominate, it's the Jewish agenda of white race replacement that always dominates. So, for instance, feminists, they always fall silent when anybody brings up the problem of rape. Because, you know, when you look at rape in Scandinavia, it's not Scandinavian men who are raping women, levels that you find in a war zone. It's non-white immigrants. And yet, where are the feminists opposing this? There are no candlelight marches against Islamization. They're silent because the feminist agenda is always trumped by the Jewish anti-white race replacement agenda. And we need to break up the coalition of the left by making clear that these non-Jewish groups on the left that are part of the leftist coalition will never get their way whenever their values conflict with white race replacement. It's true of,
that's right.
Yeah, it's true of gays and lesbians. It's true of feminists. It's true of the environmentalists. All of these groups, they routinely get steamrolled whenever there's a chance to bring in more diversity.
Well, on that note, is Judaic Christianity compatible with white nationalism?
Well, when you put the Judeo in there, yeah, sort of prejudices me.
Yeah, because there's a lot of, I know there's a lot of nationalists that, you know, the Christian versus pagan argument.
Yeah, I think that's an important discussion to have. I think that the value system of Christianity is incompatible with white nationalism. I think that if you look at the suicidal values, if you will, that a lot of whites do have programmed into them, they are justified in terms of Christian doctrine, Christian attitudes. And, you know, we'd be better off weaning these people away from these attitudes. When you start talking about the necessity of taking our own side in ethnic conflicts, the first thing a lot of people will say is, well, I mean, that goes against my Christian values, turning the other cheek and things like that. It's a problem. It's definitely a problem. So I think we need to have a mature discussion of this within our ranks. I'm not a Christian. I've never been a Christian in the sense that I believe in the Christian value system. And I think that it's a weakness in our race. It's one of the weaknesses that has allowed Jews so much power over us. Because, of course, if you believe the New Testament, then the Jews have a particularly important place in the history of mankind and in the salvation history of mankind. And that has given them a great deal of power over us, for one thing. So my tendency is to think that Christianity is one of the weaknesses in our society. And I think that as Western man, as whites become less influenced by Christianity, I think that maybe that is going to open up the possibility of being less, sheep-like and weak in the face of our impending genocide, basically. So that's my hope.
Well, another weakness we have, and you talk about it in a chapter called The Perils of Positive Thinking. Ultimately, you say it cannot save our people. Can you talk about this?
Yeah, The Perils of Positive Thinking. I wrote that because and The Perils of Positive Thinking piece sort of relates to the blame ourselves meme that goes around too. I definitely think that people who want to keep it all positive and people who want to not go populist and not talk about reasons for white people to feel resentment and anger are on the wrong track. Our race is being destroyed. We have every reason to be righteously resentful and angry about that. And the people who say, keep it positive, I think they're sort of delusional.
Yeah.
It's like sticking daisies in the rifles of soldiers. It's not a very effective countermeasure. You know, talk about taking a knife to a gunfight. How about taking a daisy to a gunfight? It's sort of a hippy-dippy non-starter thing. I think that being negative and being depressed is a bad thing. I'm a fundamentally optimistic person in terms of the struggle. But I think the people who say we got to keep it all positive are wrong. We need to fully embrace and understand the horror that's being committed against us. And we need to fully mobilize the righteous indignation that white dispossession and white extinction should be causing.
Yep. Would you say that we're still in the early stages of formulating the foundations for a white republic?
Yes and no. I mean, I think the basic ideas are there. I don't think that we need to worry too much about what legal system we'll have and will there be two houses of parliament or one or anything like that. All of that stuff has been done, basically. Whites have come up with brilliant systems of government for thousands of years. It's in our genes. We've got that handled. As soon as white people put our minds to it, as soon as we get serious about it, the political stuff will simply take care of itself. What we're in the early stage of is convincing people of the necessity of doing that. So blueprints and coming up with flags and uniforms and stuff like that, that's all premature. All of that will take care of itself. And a lot of that stuff has already been taken care of by the rich political tradition that whites already have. The United States Constitution, you could spruce that up a little bit, and it would be just fine. I honestly think so. But we're at the just beginning stages of getting people to realize the necessity of reorienting politics away from center-left, center-right stuff that we're bickering about, which doesn't really matter, towards preserving our race. Once people get their minds wrapped around the danger and the necessity of moving towards a white republic, politics will take care of itself. But we're just at the beginning of that journey.
Now, what can you say to willing, intelligent folks who they're passionate about this cause but don't know what they can do?
It depends on where they are in their lives, what they have going for them, if they're just starting out, if they're well established, if they have a lot of independence, or if they're very dependent on others for their livelihood. So there are a lot of different options. I guess the first thing I would say to anybody is to just get educated about these things and get passionate about it. Second is to take stock of your life and determine what you can do, what you're willing to give up, what you're willing to spend, and therefore what you can do within those parameters. I think it's very important for you to meet other people in your area who share these views, but you got to be really careful because, you know, some of the best people I know are white nationalists, and some of the worst people I've ever encountered are white nationalists. You got to be a little careful about who you meet. You know, don't invite people to your house that you've never met before. That can be a very big mistake. People on the left are very careful about that. They're involved in left-wing organizing and stuff like that. They always pick neutral places to meet people. They don't invite somebody they've never met to their house. So we need to be smart about things like that. So get educated and start making connections with like-minded people in your area. Those are the first things that you can do. After that, the direction you go sort of depends on where you are in your life, what your resources are, etc. If you're retired, if you're quite comfortable, you might consider becoming a more open advocate. If you're just a college student starting out in life, you don't want to go through life with a big cloud of controversy over your head, you might want to think about being a secret agent rather than a standard bearer, a public standard bearer. The point that I try and make in New Right versus Old Right and my other writings is that, again, we have to be willing to accept a whole range of different white options, right? And we have to allow every white person who's racially conscious to determine his or her own level of explicitness and involvement. And we're not going to be chewing them out and saying, you coward. I don't know why certain people make the decisions they make, right? Especially people I've never met. And I'm not going to question their decisions. I will try and persuade everybody to expand their comfort zone, right? To do more. I'm constantly trying to persuade people to do more. But I respect people who need to keep it on the down low, so to speak, who want to be secret agents. We need people like that, because if every person who believes what we believe suddenly decided on national coming out as a white nationalist day to out themselves, well, the system would have them in its beams, and a lot of these people would be scarred and jobless and friendless and be harmed by it, and that would only make the system stronger and the movement weaker. So I don't want that to happen. So I think we need to
stay in the nationalist closet.
Some people need to, and we need to respect those decisions. Other people who can afford to be out there, they should be out there. And I want there to be more explicit white nationalists. I want there to be people in every community that are known as white nationalists. I talked to Robert Taylor of the band Changes recently, and he talked about his own activism. And he said one of the most important things for any activist to think about is, first of all, you've got to sell yourself as a person before you can sell your message, your program. And I think that's a very important thing for people to contemplate. Because if you're living in a community and you're not very well known in that community, And suddenly you become an explicit white nationalist. Well, you know, you're going to be the local crank because a lot of people are not going to know who you are. And they're only going to know you as somebody who has aberrant radical political views. That's probably not a good way of going about it. You're not going to do much for the cause, and you're not going to do much for yourself. You're going to find that you're eventually going to get kind of alienated and burned out, and we don't want that. We want people to stick with this in the long haul. So what do you do if you want to become the local white nationalist guy? Well, first of all, it's important for people to know who you are without the politics, right? It's important for you to be a good dad and a good little league coach and a member of various community groups and some guy who's involved with the art show, or just anything that makes you a public known figure and sells you as an individual. If you're a well-established member of a community, people like you for who you are. People know that you're responsible and public-spirited and altruistic and trustworthy. And then it comes out that you have some kind of aberrant political views, it's not going to hurt you as much. And in fact, by being a stand-up guy and a member of the community, it's actually going to advertise positively those views. And so one of the things I'm going to say to everybody who wants to be involved with this thing is to make yourself as good a person as possible, as an individual and as a member of the community. Be as well-liked and likable and deserving of being liked as possible. Be involved. You know, if it's animal rights or organizing a farmer's market or whatever, be involved. Sell yourself as an individual. Be a person who's trusted. And when your ideas come out or when you decide to talk about your ideas, you're going to have some authority and it's going to cushion the blow. And you're going to find that you might be in a very strong position to actually persuade people and change people's minds. So that's something to think about. So Robert Taylor said, sell yourself first before you sell your ideas. Establish yourself first before you start establishing your ideas. I think that's a very wise bit of advice.
Yeah, it reminds me of Kai Muros. You know, he's right. I hate to say it, but in today's world, you have to be well packaged and also sell the idea culturally. Nationalism has to look cool. People have to want to be a part of it. Unfortunately, that's how it is.
That's true. And isn't it always better to be cool anyway? Jonathan Bowden talks about that too. Part of the appeal of our ideas is that they are a little out there. What you ideally want is you want our advocates to be people who are intelligible and respectable and well established in their communities, but they got something a little dangerous and odd about them, you know, because that's also very appealing, right? You don't want to be totally out there. You don't want to be some guy with long stringy hair and a sandwich board standing in the park baying about the end of the race or something like that. That just makes you the local crank. But, you know, if you're totally indistinguishable from any other milquetoast Rotarian, that's not a good thing either. So what you got to be is you got to be the well-respected local guy who's a little touched and a little different, a little demonic. You've got to have something, a quality of idealism, a visionary quality that sets you apart. And so I think that's a hard thing to get. You got to be a little cooler than the rest of people, a little more dangerous than the rest of people, but you can't be totally out there. And I think most people who are nationalists, that would be a good balance, right? It'd be a good balance to be well-respected, securely employed, member of your community, but also be somebody that people look to as like, wow, this guy is not just together, but he's a little further out there than the rest of us. And he has a vision that suddenly doesn't seem totally aberrant and crazy and evil, but something that you want to hear about. You're the well-known local white nationalist, but you're kind of untouchable because you've sold yourself and established yourself. That can happen. That can happen. And that's a good model to look towards.
Well, I really see the new countercultures coming out, and it's young nationalists. I see, you know, good looking, well dressed, they're fun, they're trendsetters, they have an edge. I think we're going to see a lot of that coming out probably even in the next 10 years.
I totally agree. I think the the trend that I've seen since I've gotten involved with this, I've been really involved with this for 14 years now. The trend has been every year, it seems like the average age of people involved is younger. The average education level is a little higher. The sex ratio thing is a little more balanced every year. When I got started, I was like the youngest person involved, and it was a room of gray-headed men. Okay?
Yeah.
Now it's a room with 30% women or 40% women in some groups, and the average age of people is under 40. That's a huge change.
Yeah.
And I think that's a change that really makes us, makes me hopeful, because you need to be able to look and see the future of our cause. When the cause is over 60, it doesn't have much future, but younger people have more future. And so when I see younger people who are really together involved in this, it's just encouraging. It's a concrete proof that our race has a little bit more of a future than it did just a few years ago. One of the things I like to say is that we do represent the interests. We strive to represent the interests of all white people. But at the same time, we also have to bear in mind, back of our mind maybe, that whites as a race do not have a future right now. We might be becoming the whites who have a future. And that's what I see when I go to these gatherings now. When I went to the London Forum meeting back in September, it was a very impressive group of people, and I really felt these are white people with a future. It might not be the whole race right now, but there is a group of whites who are forming now that do have a future, and that's very encouraging.
Well, as we end the hour, please share any closing remarks for us and give us your website and book details.
Okay, well, I've written two books now. One is called Confessions of a Reluctant Hater, and the other is New Right versus Old Right. And both of those are available from Countercurrents Publishing. I am the owner of Countercurrents. I'm the editor-in-chief. Countercurrents is also a website and a webzine. The webzine is officially called North American New Right, but everyone just calls it Countercurrents. And to get to it, you go to counter-currents.com. That's counter-currents.com. I really recommend you check our work out. I'm prejudiced, but I think it's the best English language right-wing, new right kind of webzine out there.
I'd agree.
We try and publish new stuff every weekday. A number of days, we have multiple new things on the website. It's a growing community. It's a growing movement. It's getting younger and smarter and cooler and more effective. And every day I get up, I feel new concrete reasons to be hopeful for the future. So I really want to thank you for all the work you're doing at Red Ice Radio. I think you're part of this rising tide, and I really appreciate the chance to be on your show.
All right. Thank you so much. Why do I keep harping on this subject? Because I don't want to live in a monoculture with a mono mind and a mono system, because that's what's being created intentionally. Why is this vital to prevent? I addressed this in the outro of my last interview with Tim Murdoch, where I discussed the metaphysical aspect of preserving ethnicity and culture. This is not just about something biological. So please listen to it if you're interested. Well, you may not agree with the idea of an ethno-state, but who are you to say what others shouldn't have? I have zero issues with any group of people who would like to pull away and form a society of their own peacefully. For example, if the Tamil people, a Dravidian ethnic group, created an ethno-state, you know that Westerners would support it. What if a group of mixed-race people wanted to peacefully secede and have a mini-country of their own with only mixed-heritage occupants? How about if a group of African Americans said they wanted to preserve their African traditions by seceding and creating a state of their own to live separately in order to preserve their traditions instead of becoming a part of the American melting pot? Or what if a group of gays, feminists, or communists wanted to secede peacefully and form a republic of their own? Would you be against it? Now, what about if a group of European Americans seceded peacefully and created a white republic? If you felt friction internally, resistance to this idea, then you aren't as high-minded and evolved as you think you are. If you really desire freedom, then we should be standing for political and social pluralism for all. And the only way we can truly facilitate this is through secession and nationalism. I've done several interviews on this idea because it is the way forward to break up the current monopoly of power and suppression, whether it's political, racial, physical, environmental, financial, etc., etc. There's nothing hateful about people wanting to live with the people they love in a way that they desire. No one wants to be tolerated. They want to be accepted. This happens when you live with the people who are most like yourself. You can find me, Lana Loctiff, on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, Stitcher, and on RSS. If you like what we do and you want to help support our work, please sign up for a Red Ice membership to get full access to our radio archives. You can do so by visiting redicecreations.com or radio314.com. I'll leave you with a song by a group called HUVA Network, which stands for Humans Under Visual Atmospheres. It's a musical collaboration between a Swede named Magnus Bergesen of Solar Fields and a Frenchman named Vincent Villiers of Ace Dana. The song is called Blank. Talk soon.